The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
We are not a law enforcement agency. We are, except for in a very narrow context, we are not a regulator. We are focused on helping network defenders across this country secure their organizations from cybersecurity threats. And I think that that purity of purpose really gives us an important mission and a significant challenge to address in this country.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 23rd, 2021. Tim Maurer is Senior Counselor for Cybersecurity to the Secretary of Homeland Security. Jen Daskal serves as Deputy General Counsel at DHS, focused on cybersecurity, and Eric Goldstein serves as the Executive Assistant Director for Cybersecurity for CISA, DHS's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Together, they joined the Lawfare podcast in what has to be the most complicated recording we've ever done. Part of it, the part with Tim Maurer and Eric Goldstein, was done before a live audience. The other part, with Jen Daskal, was done separately, and we knitted it all together so that it sounds like they were all in the same room talking to an audience. We covered a lot of ground. What are the Biden administration's priorities in cybersecurity domestically? How is DHS using its new authorities that it has received in the National Defense Authorization Act? How has CISA grown as an agency? And what would success in cybersecurity look like if the administration pursues its goals effectively? It's the Lawfare Podcast, April 23rd. DHS leadership talks cybersecurity. So, Tim, get us started. You've had time to get your feet wet. You've been in office for 3 months. What are you guys thinking about? How is cyber policy at DHS going to be different under the Biden administration than it was under the Trump administration, or will it be different?
Yeah, thank you, Ben. And first of all, thank you very much for having us today. It is month three for me at the Department of Homeland Security. I've quickly learned that that is an eternity in government time already, and days seem like weeks. But it's been an exciting time because cybersecurity is clearly a top priority for the administration, for the president. You know, in December, as president-elect, he already issued a statement dedicated to cybersecurity, and it's also top priority for Secretary Mayorkas. In fact, I remember in my first week when I joined in February, the secretary was very keen to early on highlight that cybersecurity is a threat and challenge that we face as a nation, and that he, as the Secretary of Homeland Security, is committed to tackle during his tenure. He issued an initial set of remarks already in his first month in office that issued a call for action to tackle ransomware more effectively, which has been, you know, hitting schools, hospitals, local governments around the country, but also tackling and building a more robust and diverse workforce. And that was quickly followed by a more substantive speech in March, where the secretary outlined his vision for the department's work. And not only did he outline his vision, but he was also very keen to make sure that it's focused on action. So the speech also outlined a series of sprints that would last 60 days each, dedicated to a set of priority issues. and to make sure that we will be focusing on actually driving action through the department across the components. CISA is obviously front and center, but there's also the Secret Service, Homeland Security Investigations, the Coast Guard, and TSA, which many people will not be familiar with, actually have important cybersecurity roles and responsibilities that we hope to advance in the coming weeks and months.
So what are those sprints? You know, you say these 60-day sprints. Most people don't think of dramatic improvement in cybersecurity happening in 60 days at a time. What are you guys thinking of in terms of a 60-day or a series of 60-day sprints?
That's a great question. And the sprints are actually designed to complement a series of more medium-term priorities that I'll get back to in a second. But the idea of the sprints is essentially designed to think through how can we truly move the needle in specific priority areas where we leverage the office of the secretary and the secretary himself by elevating work that is happening across the department, by removing roadblocks on issues where the staff has worked on for years, but there may be, you know, it's a big bureaucracy. Sometimes things get stuck and the secretary's office can help unstuck them. Or third, launch new initiatives in areas where the threat has evolved or where new work needs to be done. So the work is not expected to be completed within the 60 days. It's rather to be thinking through how can we come up with an action plan for each of the sprints to then leverage the secretary and the weight of the secretary's office to support the work of the components. And I think that the real value for a department like the Department of Homeland Security for these sprints is that our responsibility is so significant across various sectors. If you look at CISA and cybersecurity, but also TSA and Coast Guard, that for us to have a specific strategic direction, but also a sense of urgency, these sprints are a useful management tool and a good communication tool when it comes to partnering with external stakeholders during that period of time. A quick note on these medium-term priorities, it's clear that these sprints are not going to distract from the most important priorities right now, right? So the White House just announced that we've actually just wound down the two unified cyber coordination groups in the wake of the two significant campaigns. But if we just think of the campaign exploiting SolarWinds, the time to build back better will be measured in not weeks, but rather months, potentially years, in terms of the work that has to go into protecting the federal government. So that is a key priority. Strengthening CISA with all the various provisions in the NDA is a second. That's a long-term priority. But then also keeping an eye on protecting elections, democratic institutions, the non-executive part of government, and supply chain integrity, as well as some on-the-horizon issues like the transition to post-quantum encryption algorithms are long-term priorities that the secretary will be paying attention to. The series of sprints is really for this first year to capture the attention of the building and the department in six specific priority areas and make work happen in that area.
Tim, just tick through for us the six sprint areas that are the sort of initial priority. So you have ransomware. Are they concurrent 60-day sprints or sequential? Because you line up your 60 days in a row, you know, that's a full year. Is it imagined that way, or is it imagined as sort of concurrent 60-day sprints for different parts of the outfit?
A great question. And the six 60-day sprints are not meant to be a hidden marathon that just aligned perfectly to a full year. They're actually chosen in terms of topics that, apart from a few parts of DHS, like our policy team, for example, that's the node for all the action plans, the focus areas are going to differ so that it's not the same part of the department that will be mobilized and that will be expected to drive action within that 60-day period consecutively. So it's rather going to be for a few parts of the department, there will be one or two sprints throughout the year with a clear action plan and a set of expectations. So the first one is ransomware. The reason why that is, while ransomware has been around for a long time, the ability for actors to monetize it has truly made this a new phenomenon in the last two or three years alone, has evolved to be a national security threat. Last fall, CISA, together with the FBI and HHS, issued an alert of hospitals and healthcare facilities being targeted. So there's some concern about the potential risk, specifically with the COVID-19 pandemic. And the workforce one is a second one. It's part of the broader administration effort to also elevate diversity, equity, and inclusion. The ransomware one was launched at the beginning of this month, will last 60 days. The workforce one will kick off in early May and will run for the next 60 days. So there will be a 30-day overlap. And that is because the two were part of the call for action by the secretary in February. After that, there will be consecutive ones, so sequential. The third one will focus on industrial control systems, where if you think of the incident in Florida earlier this year with the water facility, that kind of illustrated to people around the world and in the country how vulnerable these systems remain and the work that remains to be done. The fourth one will focus on cybersecurity in the context of transportation. So this is where the Coast Guard, with respect to the maritime transport system, has significant responsibilities, but also TSA when it comes to surface transportation. And then the fifth sprint will focus on election security and continuing to protect the integrity of election. The next one is already around the corner, just like any subsequent elections are always around the corner, so that's an ongoing effort. And then the last one will focus on the international dimension of our work, working with our partners to help build capacity. And CISA actually just released its first CISA global strategy, which is a foundation of the international work that CISA hopes to build out in the coming weeks and months.
So talk to us about CISA. This is an agency that until last year, most Americans had never heard of. Last year, it becomes the center of a whole lot of, I think, mostly unwanted attention. It also gains a lot of prestige as a result of that set of incidents. But of course, the director gets fired. It becomes politically controversial. Now you have, I guess, a turn the page situation. What is CISA's role for the next few years? And what are you guys trying to do?
Great. Thanks, Ben. And first of all, thanks to you and the Lawfare team. I think I can say with some confidence that I have been a reader and listener since near day one. And so really so good to be here. And thanks for all the work that you and the team have been doing over the years. Now, this is really an exciting time for CISA. And I think it's useful to take a step back for the audience just to reflect on who CISA is and what we do, since we are still, even after the events of the last year, not the best known agency in the U.S. government. And CISA is the only agency that is focused solely on the mission of improving the nation's cybersecurity. We are not a law enforcement agency. We are, except for in a very narrow context, we are not a regulator. We are focused on helping network defenders across this country secure their organizations from cybersecurity threats. And I think that that purity of purpose really gives us an important mission and a significant challenge to address in this country. Looking at where we are now, as you noted, Ben, CISA played a critical role in helping to secure the general election last year through collaboration with our state and local partners. And going forward, we're focused on a few key areas. One of them is helping federal civilian executive branch agencies adopt the necessary security measures to protect themselves against these sorts of sophisticated cybersecurity intrusions that, frankly, we are seeing impact our government time and again. And CISA does this by providing cybersecurity tools, by providing binding directives upon federal agencies, requiring them to take certain steps, and by providing incident response assistance and threat hunting assistance to actually go onto networks, find the adversaries that have broken in, and remove them. But we also have a critical mission outside of the federal civilian executive branch as well, particularly working with our nation's critical infrastructure and with our state, local, tribal, and territorial partners. And Tim mentioned our secretary's first sprint focused on ransomware, which is a key example of this non-federal mission. Because I mentioned, we're not a regulator for most of the critical sectors. And so our role is to make sure that every organization in this country understands the right things to do to protect their network and then provide them with voluntary assistance. This can be vulnerability assessments, it can be best practices, it can be alerts to help them take measures to protect themselves. And then when an incident does occur, when there's an intrusion campaign, like the recent campaign involving Microsoft Exchange Server, working in a partnership with our fellow agencies across the U.S. government and with the private sector to make sure that we have a concerted whole-of-nation response against these significant threats. It's a really exciting mission to be in right now, but there's definitely a lot of work to do.
So, Jen, why is a lawyer part of this conversation? I mean, when we think about the Biden administration's priorities in cybersecurity, it is not obvious why the deputy general counsel of DHS should be, you know, part of the outward facing components of that conversation. What are you doing here?
It's a good question, but it's great to join. So I joined DHS to be part of the General Counsel's office, but in particular was brought on to have a particular focus on cyber and technology issues. And it's a really kind of exciting time to be working on these issues because there's such crossover between the legal issues and the policy issues. And this is an area that the secretary has placed a huge priority on. It's an area that the administration has placed a huge priority on. And there is so much that we are doing and that we need to continue to do to take steps to increase our resiliency, to work with the private sector, to modernize our cyber defenses, to ensure a whole of government approach in doing so, and building and promoting what the secretary has discussed as a free and secure cyberspace. And all of this obviously raises really important policy choices, but those policy choices are also intertwined with the law.
And what is your sense of the fundamental legal choices that DHS is facing right now as it confronts an attempt to be more forward-leaning, more aggressive in the cybersecurity domain?
So I think that these are intertwined policy and legal choices. If just to kind of step back for a second, I mean, I think, you know, everyone who's probably listening to this podcast knows this, but cybersecurity is not just kind of an abstract technocratic concept. It's about people. It's about protecting our democracy. It's fundamental, foundational to our economic security, to the protection of our fundamental rights, to our ability to provide healthcare and distribute vaccines across the country so we can beat back this pandemic. And as we kind of think through and work through all these issues, we need to do cybersecurity well, we need to do it right, and we need to do it in a way that's lawful and is consistent with our commitment to privacy and protection of civil rights and civil liberties and the rule of law. And that's, I think, one of the key elements of the administration's approach and certainly the department's approach. And that's when we talk about a free and secure cyberspace, we are talking about a cyberspace that is both free and secure. And what makes it free is in part the commitment to law and acting in ways that are consistent with our legal principles and our norms that underlie those legal principles.
So, Jen, you've referred to a free and secure cyberspace, which at one level sounds self-explanatory and at another level operates at a sufficient level of vagueness that, you know, it can mean almost anything you want it to mean. How would we know a free and secure cyberspace if it had hit us over the head?
It's a great question. I mean, I think we Secretary Mayorkas talked about this in his March 31st speech about the goal of, you know, our goal and our whole approach is to work and support a cyberspace that is both free and a cyberspace that is also secure. And this stems from a concept that the two need to be understood as going hand in hand, that we don't have to sacrifice freedom for security, and we need not sacrifice security for freedom. Far too often, and Secretary Mayorkas also talked about this, far too often cybersecurity is used as a pretext to infringe on civil liberties and human rights. But cybersecurity done right does not undermine freedom and actually promotes freedom. And I think we see this in the department. We see this through our commitment to privacy and civil liberties and our constant work towards building a secure and resilient network that enables communication and innovation and distribution of basic goods like health services, electricity, water, that is protected from attack, but also allows for communications and interactions in ways that protect civil liberties and human rights as well. And that is ultimately the goal.
You know, the last time a Democratic administration came in and dealt with security issues in the wake of an aggressive Republican administration, one of the major concerns was ensuring that the government was behaving in accord with the law. The Trump administration raised much more serious concerns about the rule of law, in my view, than did the Bush administration. That said, most of them were not in the cybersecurity domain. Did you come into office with concerns about the lawfulness of U.S. government cybersecurity activity, and specifically anything that you were aware of at DHS? And how confident are you at this stage that, you know, to the extent there were any concerns, they have been addressed?
Yeah, so I think cybersecurity is an area where there's been kind of just extraordinary bipartisan work over a long period of time. And so my joining the administration was not necessarily to right the wrongs of the past, but to continue to move forward and to continue to move forward in a way that's consistent with the commitment to the rule of law. And I think, you know, if you look at the department as a whole and CISA in particular, there is a deep and abiding commitment to ensuring that the actions are taken consistent with privacy requirements and other legal requirements. The department has chief civil rights, civil liberties and civil rights officer, chief privacy officer. CISA by statute specifies a senior privacy officer in a leadership role, and protecting sensitive and proprietary data is a foundational priority of the department in general and CISA in particular. I think that's been consistent, and it's something that we continue to focus on going forward as well.
All right, let's go to audience questions. The floor is yours.
Howdy. It's great to have you here. I have a question about what happened. You've been talking a lot about attacks on a preventative basis, but I'm curious about the policy of what happens when a state actor has successfully performed an attack. For data thefts or for electronic infrastructure attacks, there doesn't seem to be a general consensus in the public, and I'm not sure whether there's a feeling that it's settled in law what kind of responses are justified to those kinds of attacks. Is building a consensus in the public and advising what the laws and policies should be on that part of the things that that you work on, should it be a priority? And is there already a playbook that's just administration policy on that topic?
So this is a very broad question, and it implicates many people in the government beyond DHS and CISA, but let's talk about your all's role in state-level cyber attack response. What happens when somebody does something bad? And let's keep it hypothetical so that we don't, you know, put you in a position where you can't answer the question. State does something, you know, bad to the United States in the cyber domain. What is DHS's role in the response to that?
Yeah, thank you. It's a great and important question. And as you saw last week, this administration took specific action in response to a series of activity and imposed sanctions last week against Russia, which is an illustration of this broader question. If we start at the highest level, we actually do have an existing framework. We have existing international law that applies to cyberspace and the effects that are carried out through cyberspace. And there is a consensus that existing international law does apply. There are some disagreements of how international law applies, where some countries have different views, but that has been a longstanding view of the US government that there is an existing reference point, there is an existing framework, and that is international law. With respect to the activity that falls below the threshold of use of force and armed attack, the State Department has also worked on a set of voluntary norms together with the international community, where there have been a number of reports through the United Nations that provide additional insights into how the international community is currently thinking about this. And when it comes to the Department of Homeland Security, we obviously interested and focused on contributing to a stable and secure cyberspace. from the various efforts that can help contribute to this broader game and that complement the efforts of the department, namely CISA, to increase the security and stability of various systems and networks. So on the network defender side, the department obviously also has a keen interest in efforts that contribute to stability more broadly. I would add that with respect to the Secret Service and Homeland Security investigations, which are also both part of the Department of Homeland Security, both have significant law enforcement investigatory roles and responsibilities. So, for example, the Secret Service specifically is focused on cyber-enabled financial crime, and especially in the wake of COVID, was able to prevent over $2 billion in fraud losses. So the department, in addition to CISA's focus on network defense, also has a clear law enforcement investigatory piece that's tied to cybercrime and cyber-enabled crime.
So as you know, so as a dedicated reader of Lawfare, you know in February those piece put out on the National Cyber Director. But reading through that, it seems like a lot, they're taking the lead in cyber response, they're responsible for engaging with the private sector and such. And from just outside a government point of view, it seems like there's a lot of offices charged with doing very similar things. And I know we stand up groups in response to events. You mentioned the two groups that are now winding down their operations. Is there a standing coordination group or something among the cyber director and CISA? And now you've mentioned HSI and TSA and such. And I'll just take one example. The National Cyber Director is supposed to engage private sector. That's a core mission of CISA. So I'm just curious how the deconfliction is working. Are there too many chefs in the broth, or just give us your thoughts on that?
So it's a great question. First of all, I think all of us in the government's cybersecurity community, and I think all of us in the national cyber community, were delighted by the recent intent to nominate Chris Inglis as the National Cyber Director, as well as Jen Easterly as our director designate here at CISA. They are both extraordinary professionals in this field, and I think our nation will be vastly more secure having them both at the helm in their relevant posts. There are a number of existing fora within the interagency for various agencies and their operational teams to collaborate. Some of these fora spin up and spin down based upon campaigns or intrusions, and some of them, either convened by the White House or by CISA, are more steady state and operate on an ongoing basis. Certainly the NDAA passed last year creates a new model for governing cybersecurity by the U.S. government. We, of course, have Anne Neuberger, who's doing an extraordinary job as the Deputy National Security Advisor within the White House, leading the NSC efforts. We will soon, of course, have Chris as the NCD. And then, as noted, CISA plays a crucial role, as our secretary has noted, as the nation's quarterback for operational cybersecurity work. And, I think the positive thing here is that everybody involved is working towards the same mission. We are operating as one government in concert with our partners in the private sector. Certainly, there will be work to do in this new model to figure out how to optimize and make sure that we are making best use of our relevant resources and authorities. But I'm very excited for the work to come, and I think it is going to be additive rather than duplicative once we're all up and running.
So, Jen, walk us through what CISA's new authorities are, if you will.
So, CISA, in recognition of CISA's kind of critically important role in this space, CISA in the last National Defense Authorization Act was given a range of kind of critically new important authorities that better enable it to do threat detection across federal networks. It has a new administrative subpoena authority, and it has been empowered both through appropriations and authorizations to play an increasingly important role in protecting the resiliency of the federal networks across the government as well.
It seems to me, let's exclude the last administration for a moment, because they didn't even pretend, actually. But the preceding at least three or four administrations, at least since the Clinton administration, every White House has identified cybersecurity as the most important thing. We're going to have sort of a national approach to this, an all of government approach. And then the average cybersecurity hygiene of the country keeps getting worse. And with all due respect to you guys, I've heard a lot of people come into government and say, this is the time, at last our eyes are open. This is the time we're going to really focus on cybersecurity. And I guess my question is, what's different this time And why should we believe you guys when you say it, particularly with all respect to DHS, from an agency that has not built as much capacity as some other agencies in the government have, and yet has a sprawling set of responsibilities?
Yeah, Ben, let me start and then Eric can chime in as well, because I think there are a couple of factors that contribute to things being a little different for us right now in the administration, starting with the fact that in early December, we discovered the campaign exploding solar winds, which was in the midst of the transition. And both of us were part of the transition, and I can tell you that it definitely had an impact. And as you saw, the president-elect at the time already issued a statement, and there, you know, it was a dedicated statement to cybersecurity that came out in December, because it was considered to be of such importance that it was important for now President Biden to issue a statement and make clear where he thought this issue stands within his priorities. As far as I remember, it wasn't the case necessarily in the past, and it also created a lot of momentum in the early days of the administration already. The fact that we had two concurrent unified cyber coordination groups, which has never happened in the five-year history of PDD 41, also demonstrates the momentum within government that coalesced around cybersecurity. And then I think, you know, to your point about it's been a priority for a very long time, but the basic cyber hygiene has been getting worse and worse. I think it's important to also take into account that actually the number of devices and users connected to the internet has actually grown. There are some important questions to ask. What's the reference point and how we measure that? I do agree that I think we are still in a situation where it's a huge challenge if we take ransomware as an example. But there's also been a shift where now all of a sudden, because of something like ransomware and kids having to stay home because the school cannot operate, or hospitals having to reschedule surgeries, I think it's going to be much more on the minds of everyday Americans of why this is something that is affecting them directly, not just through credit card fraud, but actually because it's hitting much closer to home. So that is an opportunity to actually make some meaningful change happen in the coming months and years, because also I think CISA has transformed in recent years as well, and is doing some excellent work that's different from what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks, Ben. It's a great question, and one which, of course, we think about constantly here at CISA. If we think about your hypothesis of the fact that cyber hygiene is getting worse, I think it's worth all thinking through why that is. And I think Tim's point about the multiplication, maybe exponentially, of devices is one reason. I think one reason may be resources, right? Maybe many organizations still lack the resources to make the prudent investment in cybersecurity hygiene. I think we are now seeing real focus, both in Congress and in the Biden-Harris administration, to remediate that problem for the federal civilian executive branch. Congress, of course, gave CISA significant new resources in the recent COVID relief bill, which is a down payment on the work to be done, but certainly reflects the fact that more resources are needed to implement the solutions that we know we have to adopt. I think a second factor is attention about cybersecurity risk at the highest levels of an organization, the point where cybersecurity risk is seen as a co-equal business risk to other types of risk affecting American companies or other organizations. I think the fact that this president will soon have two senior officials at the highest levels of his administration, along with, of course, our secretary at DHS and others in the cabinet leading this issue, I think reflects the importance of this issue in a way that hasn't been the case before. And then I think the third, to Tim's point, I think we are learning as a government community about how to add value better. And one important point there is we are learning how to move past information sharing as an end in itself and moving more towards really rich operational collaboration with the private sector and with the interagency to achieve specific operational and strategic outcomes in the context of particular intrusion campaigns or threats. I will tell you, frankly, I was in DHS, had the privilege of working the agency 5 years ago. I am astonished by the progress that has been made around that kind of collaborative work in the intervening year. So I think your hypothesis has real validity. We have a lot of work to do, but I do think that this administration is focused on making some real progress towards resolving it.
Yeah, so talk to me about that progress, because as somebody who's been at DHS for a while, you know that there has long been a certain skepticism elsewhere in the government about the relative strength of the capacities at DHS relative to its degree of authority. That is, it has authority over, you know, basically the cybersecurity domestically of the United States to the extent that it's not military. And it was started from scratch, you know, not that long ago. It's not NSA in its longevity or, you know, institutional memory or the number of mathematicians and computer scientists it employs. And yet, you know, there has been significant progress over the last several years. So walk us through that. What is DHS's capacity today that wasn't true 5-6 years ago?
It's a good question, Ben. And I'd say it's significant. And I would say that Congress has recognized the delta of which you speak, which is CISA was established with a national mission to be our domestic lead for operational cybersecurity. And effectively executing that mission requires the appropriate basket of authorities and resources to understand the challenge and then make progress in resolving it. I think if you look, for example, at last year's National Defense Authorization Act, Congress provided CISA with a number of deeply impactful authorities, which we are now leveraging to great effect. Just as a few examples, we now have the ability to offer shared cybersecurity services to other federal agencies without their reimbursement. So what this now lets us do is, you know, there's 102 federal civilian agencies. We are now able to develop and offer shared services to these agencies to improve their own cybersecurity. In my mind, that is a game changer in how we think about CISA's role in government cybersecurity. Similarly, Congress authorized us to move our threat hunting to a more continuous and persistent model. So we have the ability on an ongoing basis to detect cybersecurity threats across federal civilian networks. Again, an authority that didn't exist previously. And on the resource point, you know, we are still a growing agency. We likely will continue to grow and scale to meet the national mission. But the fact that Congress included, to my knowledge, the first ever cybersecurity appropriation outside of the regular budget cycle specific to CISA's federal civilian mission reflects that recognition and the need to make further progress. So certainly we have a significant national mission. The agency is still growing, but we have the support of Congress and this administration to keep building that combination of authorities and resources needed to address the risk we're seeing.
And Ben, if I could add a point to that, because the secretary actually opened his speech last month by acknowledging a couple of hard truths, including that the government had been hacked for several months and we didn't know about it until one of the world's best cybersecurity companies alerted the government that it had been hacked. And I do think a hard truth that we need to acknowledge as well is that the government depends on the collaboration with the private sector to effectively deliver cybersecurity for the nation. The number of systems owned and operated by the private sector is just beyond the scale of what the government itself could ever protect. So it is not really a question, could CISA or the NSA do this effectively? The government writ large is dependent on working with the private sector. So if we accept that as a premise for this space, given the thousands of systems that have to be connected and protected, especially if we look at the Internet of Things moving forward, smart cities, etc., the more important question is, how do you structure those relationships effectively that you can actually achieve that public good of cybersecurity for the nation? And I would just provide two examples of, in the brief 3 months that I've been in government now, that have made me very optimistic of where CISA and the department currently stands. The first one is in conversations with the private industry, who in conversations that I've had no longer make the case and the argument that you just made, that I've in my previous life, you know, often encountered DHS having its abilities but not capabilities. But industry be actually sharing that in the last 2 to 3 years, CISA has truly turned a corner, is maturing, is providing services that the industry finds very valuable and wants to see CISA continue to grow and mature. That's a great sign because it means CISA is kind of the trusted interlocutor, is kind of the quarterback for network defense, is living up to that potential more and more. And the second point is, a recent article that described the mood at the CISA staff, which said that the staff is exhausted, which is not surprising given, you know, protecting elections, two major campaigns. But the article also referenced the high morale at the CISA staff right now. And I think another argument that is partly implied by your previous suggestion, that may not have been the case a couple of years ago. In fact, there are surveys that suggest that that was not the case at the department. So if we have a motivated workforce, if our key partners are sharing that they see CISA on the right trajectory and want to see it further strengthen and mature, those are two indicators that I think demonstrate that how far we've come already in the last few years and what we want to achieve in the coming months.
Could you talk more about the TSA? When I worked for the TSA, I remember screening passengers and luggage, not websites, and be happy if they took the laptops out of their luggage while they were screening. What is TSA's role in this space? Thank you.
Great. So I'm glad you asked about TSA. TSA is not, you know, TSA is a part, is another piece of the department that has an important role in protecting the cybersecurity of the nation, in particular, the focus on cyber resiliency of our transportation sector. But when we think about DHS and we think about cyber, obviously, oftentimes CISA comes first to mind, but CISA is not the only part of DHS that's focused on cyber. So there's TSA. The Coast Guard plays a critical role in protecting the cyber resiliency of the maritime transportation sector. It's important to note that 90% of U.S. imports and exports pass through this sector, and the Coast Guard has a really important role to play there. And we have our investigative units as well. The Secret Service and ISIS Homeland Security investigations play an important role in investigating, identifying, prosecuting cybercrime. Secret Service arrested more than 1,000 individuals just in the last year and prevented over $2 billion in potential fraud losses, and plays a very important role in investigating, prosecuting, addressing cybercrime and ransomware in particular.
It's a great question. And in addition to CISA, TSA is one of the components of the department that also has a cyber mission. So the main focus is on the surface transportation role and responsibilities, and also some of the authorities that TSA has in this space. There's a pipeline aspect to that as well, but the primary focus of the TSA cybersecurity work is dedicated to the surface transportation piece, which is similar to the Coast Guard's role when it comes to maritime transport systems. So this is actually an area where DHS, together with the Department of Transportation, as the sector risk management agency, plays a key role and is another one of those examples where the ecosystem is fairly fragmented and you have multiple players that play different roles, but where CISA actually has a dedicated program in place and works closely with TSA. So in addition to CISA playing that role with respect to other parts of the federal government, even within the Department of Homeland Security, DHS has become the kind of fallback option for other components to rely on in terms of expertise, but also initiatives.
So I want to go back to SolarWinds for a moment. You mentioned when you guys were in the transition context, this made a big impression, you know, kind of lit a fire under everyone's ass that wasn't necessarily burning at the same strength before. The other day, the government announced that the FBI had, with court approval, sort of cleaned a bunch of the servers that had been infected, which is a step that we have not seen taken before. No question in my mind of its lawfulness or a propriety given the court order. But it does suggest a step up of aggressiveness in, you know, tactical willingness to respond to things. And I guess, you guys aren't FBI, but I imagine there was some interagency discussion of taking a step like that. Is it fair to say that this is a reflection of a willingness to be more aggressive in the incident response department domestically than had been the case beforehand?
Well, Ben, I think it's certainly a recognition of the U.S. government and this administration of the risk facing our country from widespread intrusion campaigns and these sorts of vulnerabilities that can significantly impact not just the American people's information, but also to Tim's point earlier about attacks on schools and hospitals, the various services and functions upon which we use to work, educate our kids, and live our daily lives. And so I think it is part of a trend where this administration recognizes the need to take multifaceted action on a number of fronts. And Ben, you alluded to the action taken by this administration last week against various acts undertaken by the Russian government. I think we should see this all as responding to the need to treat this moment and treat this risk with the heightened sense of urgency that it deserves. And I think we will see continued deliberation in the administration to consider any and all steps that we can take collectively to make sure that we're protecting the American people from this risk.
So just for those who could not hear the question, she asks whether you can address what institutions can push to improve cybersecurity practices in U.S. businesses. Is it more efficient to improve engineering education or to change liability rules?
Sure. Both great questions. So on the first one, I think it is less critical to figure out which institutions can push cybersecurity best practices to U.S. businesses than it is to ensure that all U.S. businesses are receiving the right information about cybersecurity best practices from whatever trusted organization they are able to receive it from. And so at CISA, we are very focused on working through a wide range of institutions, whether it's academia, civil society, the private sector cybersecurity community, sectoral organizations, or other agencies that have relationships with their own sectors in their purview, to make sure that we are pushing out the right information and consistent information through every possible venue. And if an organization has a problem that they are hearing about cybersecurity best practices from too many sources, well, that's not an ideal state and we should try to rationalize that, but I'd much rather organizations hear about what to do in cybersecurity from too many places than none at all. And the key is to make sure that we are establishing a common baseline for cybersecurity best practices, and then ensuring that organizations understand that their security controls and defensive measures should be tailored based upon the risk posed to their organization and the data and services that they provide and hold based upon prudent risk analysis. On the second point, I certainly don't think that it's either or. I think improving the cybersecurity, the diversity and depth of the cybersecurity workforce in this country is absolutely critical. As Tim noted, that is one of our secretary's early cybersecurity sprints. And at the department, we are deeply focused on working with academia, with the nonprofit sector to make sure that the cybersecurity workforce in this country is both growing and looks like America in all of its facets. But at the same time, we do need to make sure that U.S. businesses have the right package of incentives to implement the right cybersecurity measures. And so certainly we do want to make sure that business models are aligned so that, as I mentioned earlier, senior executives who do not work in cybersecurity as an avocation still appropriately understand these risks and are incentivized to invest in appropriate measures to protect their companies.
All right. We have to wrap up, but I want to ask you both what we should be looking forward to in the weeks and months to come. Tim, you've been in for 3 months. It seems like an eternity to you. It's a blink of the eye to us. Over the next year, how will I know if DHS under Secretary Mayorkas is succeeding or failing in or stagnating in cyber mission? How will the world look different if everything you guys are working on right now proceeds apace and is successful versus if you're unable to get stuff done? How does the world look different over the next year?
Ben, that's a great question. I think there is, for each sprint, there will be a dedicated set of goals that we hope to achieve, cognizant that within 60 days, you know, it's more about how can you move the needle a little bit and set it on the right path so that you can see meaningful change in the medium to long term. There are a couple of ones where we're excited about the work ahead in the next couple of weeks and months, starting with the first event when he actually gave the speech, which was co-hosted with the Girl Scouts and Hampton University. And Hampton University is a historically Black university that's a center of excellence for cyber, recognized by both NSA and DHS, where as part of our workforce sprint, we are going to, we've committed to publish the DHS data that will allow us to be transparent about diversity, equity, and inclusion at the department and make that data also transparently available. And we will launch partnerships to further advance that mission, including the Girl Scouts, but also the work that we're doing now behind the scenes in the lead up to the sprint. I think we'll have some good work to just on that particular front show progress that we are making. Ransomware is another example where it's actually a very complicated problem. If you look at the full kind of kill chain of the ransomware from, it's actually in terms of malware an issue that could be protected against fairly easily in terms of backup systems and with basic cyber hygiene, but because it's going after the weakest link and resource poor organizations, there's a challenge of how do you get to all of them. But there is work we can do by leveraging the secretary to and the department to reach out to more organizations across the country, leveraging the current momentum and awareness, but then also making sure that other parts of the government ideally make this one of their priorities, because it's also about following the money, following where the marketplaces are, where the malware, but also the infrastructure is being put in place. And then you can measure us against some of the more on the horizon issues that we've previewed in the speech. For example, putting a plan together that prepares us for the transition to post-quantum encryption algorithms and making sure that it's not just those who are already well-resourced or have the technical capacity to think about these issues that may happen 5 to 10 years from now, but that it's a smooth and equitable transition so that it's also smaller organizations where there would be a plan in place where the government makes sure that while this will be an industry-led effort, the government fulfills its role of making sure nobody's left behind. So as we advance the vision outlined in the speech, there will be specific issues that you can measure us against, both of issues that were already announced in the speech and further announcements we will be making in the coming months related to those activities.
Eric, what about at CISA itself? How does the world look different if the building that you're working on over the next year is successful than if it's not?
Sure. So I think it does bear noting that CISA, of course, is the executing arm of many of the initiatives that Tim described in coordination with our partner components within DHS. But certainly, I think we'll see some significant changes over the next year. I think a lot of these changes are going to be fairly invisible to the public. A lot of them are going to involve how do we improve our visibility into cybersecurity risks within federal agencies? How do we deepen our operational collaboration with the companies in this country that are most critical to national cybersecurity? But a few elements I think will be a bit more public. And one example of that I mentioned are our new authorities in the National Defense Authorization Act from last year. We are working now on implementing a new organization called the Joint Cyber Planning Office, the JCPO. And that is really going to be the maturation of a lot of our work to lead what we call joint cyber defense operations for the U.S. government and with the private sector. And that office is going to stand up in the months to come and is going to be the focal point for cyber defense planning, bringing together stakeholders from the government and the private sector to make sure that before a major intrusion campaign occurs, we've planned for it and we've exercised that plan. And then when the event does happen inevitably, we have a whole of nation effort on the same page led by CISA to drive our response.
We are going to leave it there. Eric Goldstein, Tim Maurer, thank you both so much for joining us today. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Department of Homeland Security, who made their officials available to discuss these matters. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast, so share us on Facebook and all the social medias, tweet us, you know, pin us on Pinterest, that stuff. Leave us a rating or review wherever you found us. The Lawfare podcast merch is available at the Lawfare store. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo and Bryce Clem. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.